time last week, for the last couple of weeks, talking about Barton W. Stone. He was a Presbyterian, and a kind of what we would probably call an old school Presbyterian. He got in trouble with the synod, started the Springfield Presbytery in an effort to restore what he thought should have been the case all along. And then as he continued to study, he eventually came to the conclusion that he shouldn't have started the Springfield Presbytery because it was just divisive. And so the six men that started the Springfield Presbytery wrote what's called the Last Will and Testament. And they decided that that organization was going to die because it was unbiblical. Tonight, we'll start talking about Thomas and Alexander Campbell. Now, they're Presbyterians, but they come from Scotland and a different kind of wing, if that's the right way to say it, a different part of the Presbyterian tradition. Thomas comes to America before Alexander does, and so we have this separate movement that's starting. Now, Thomas is preaching in Pennsylvania. Barton W. Stone is preaching down in Kentucky. And it's not like they have the internet, so they don't have close communication with each other. But as after we develop Stone and then the Campbells, and then we're going to talk about Thomas O'Kelly, we'll kind of talk about how these three movements found out about each other. So let's talk about Thomas Campbell. He was born in 1763, died in 1854, and his seminal contribution to the Restoration movement in terms of published material is what's called the Declaration and Address of the Christian Association of Washington. So let's see if we can figure out what the Christian Association of Washington was all about, because you have to know that to kind of understand the Declaration and Address. Thomas began his preaching career as a Presbyterian, but he was in the wing of the Presbyterian Church called the Seceder Presbyterians. He was preaching in Ireland. The Seceders were a group of ministers who had left the Church of Scotland in 1633, and they formed a presbytery, but they called it an associate presbytery. They didn't want to leave the Church of Scotland, but kind of like Barton W. Stone had done, they had felt that they had been mistreated by the synod and the presbytery that they were a part of. And so they formed the associate presbytery. And part of the issue that, at least one of the issues that figured prominently in the formation of the associate presbytery, was who would be able to appoint ministers. And they had different groups of people within churches. There was the landowners, and Scotland had a kind of, it impressed me as being something kind of like a feudal system, where you had landowners and then you had a lot of sharecroppers that lived on the land that was owned by a major landowner. Well, the landowners felt like they had the right to appoint the ministers that were going to work in a particular area, and the lay people, the regular farmers, didn't think that that was the case. And so you had the secession movement. And then you have, even within the secession movement, you had another split in 1747. And this is a split between the burghers and the anti-burghers. And I don't know a whole lot about that split. It doesn't really figure prominently in the Restoration in America. But the reason that I talk about all of those things was Thomas Campbell was affected by this partisan turmoil as he began his ministry. And it just seemed to permeate the entire religious world that he was a part of. So you had the presbytery, then you had the associate presbytery, then within the associate presbytery, you had the burghers and the anti-burghers. People just couldn't get along with each other. Well, that bothered Thomas. So his doctor advised him that he needed to go to America, mostly because of the weather, that the weather was better in America than it was in Scotland. I don't know anything about Scotland and Ireland, but I know it tends to be pretty wet. So he immigrates to America in 1807. When he gets to America, he finds a group of ministers who had already immigrated from Ireland to Pennsylvania. And so he's commissioned as a minister by the Presbyterian Associate Synod of North America. Remember, this is the Associate Synod of North America. And he's assigned to the Chartiers, and I'm not sure that I know how to pronounce that word, Presbytery in Western Pennsylvania. So he's around a group of seceder Presbyterians. And he, just shortly after he was appointed a minister, he got in trouble with the synod, with the presbytery. And the reason he got in trouble was that he was not practicing closed communion. In the Presbyterian Church, if you weren't a member of the presbytery in that particular place, you couldn't participate in communion. And we saw that when we started talking about the First Great Awakening and how they had the halfway covenant so that people could baptize their babies even though they had not been in fellowship with the church and they hadn't signed the covenant. So this is a big deal. He also had some problems regarding congregational autonomy. And I'm not certain the nature of those problems, but everything that I read talks about him being censured by the synod for those two reasons: offering communion to Presbyterians that were outside of the synod's jurisdiction and congregational autonomy. So after 2 years, he leaves the Presbyterian Synod of Pennsylvania, the Associate Synod of Pennsylvania. And he organized what he called the Christian Association of Washington. This was about the year 1809. When it was first organized, Thomas did not intend for it to be a church. It was just a study group. When it started, they had 21 people that were a part of this study group. All of them lived around Washington, Pennsylvania. And 2 years later, by 1811, they had formed that, reformed that group as the Brush Run Church. And it was called the Brush Run Church because it was in this little, that they call a creek, a run, back in that part of the world. And it was on Brush Creek or Brush Run. So that's what they called this church. This is a chalk drawing that I found of the meeting house of the Brush Run Church. And understand, it's not very big. It was 21 members when it first formed. I don't know how big the membership was in 1811 after 2 years, but no doubt it had grown. So pretty unassuming kind of building. They were in Brush Run, Pennsylvania. Barton W. Stone is down in Cane Ridge, Kentucky. And I have seen the church that Stone preached in Cane Ridge. I've not seen this one in Brush Run. So Alexander, who is Thomas's son, follows his father to America in 1812. Alexander had become convinced that in order for baptism to be practiced the way it was practiced in the New Testament, it had to be by immersion. This wasn't the first time that anybody had ever come to that conclusion. The Baptists had been practicing baptism by immersion for a long time. So the Brush Run Church, when Alexander came and convinced his father that they ought to baptize by immersion, the Brush Run Church began to practice that as a general rule. Well, in 1815, the Brush Run Church was invited to join the Redstone Baptist Association. And it was largely because of the similar stance that these two groups had on the question of baptism by immersion. The Brush Run Church en masse agreed to join the Redstone Baptist Association. So they seceded from the presbytery. They decided that they would join the Redstone Baptist Association, but they had one, what they perceived as critical issue, and their one critical provision, if they were going to join the Redstone Baptist Association, is that they would still be allowed to teach and preach whatever they learned from the scriptures. Now, the source was the scriptures. And that's why that was so important. They wanted to be able to teach and preach without interference from the Redstone Baptist Association whatever they learned from the scriptures. So they did. And if you look at Thomas's habit of getting in trouble with different associations pretty quickly, this was a long time. 1815, the Brush Run Church joined the Redstone Baptist Association. And by all accounts, they had a pleasant relationship until 1824. Thomas and Alexander leave the Redstone Baptist Association and they associated themselves with the Mahoning Baptist Association. And I'm not absolutely convinced that I understand everything about why they left Redstone and joined the Mahoning Association. Now, this is not like what had happened with Barton W. Stone. Remember, Barton W. Stone established a presbytery and then decided this presbytery, any kind of organization that was larger than the local congregation, was unbiblical. So they willed the presbytery that they had formed to die. Well, Campbell keeps moving from one association to another. I think one of the reasons that may have been behind this was Alexander was holding a lot of debates, mostly with Catholics, and having the backing of the Mahoning Baptist Association or the Redstone Baptist Association gave him credibility so that the Catholics would debate him. Now, I can't find that anywhere. That's just my reasoning on why this may have happened, because no Catholic wants to debate the preacher from the Brush Run Church. They want to debate the champion from a Baptist association. And I think that may have been a part of what was going on. I can't say that for sure, but I do know that during this period, there were a lot of debates, usually with Catholics. So let's try to understand Campbell's basic approach to biblical matters. Campbell comes from a background where ministers were educated in the philosophies. And so Campbell has read John Locke, he's read Aristotle, he's read Seneca. He is a well-educated man, well-read. And it seems to me, and Campbell quotes John Locke fairly regularly. John Locke's Enlightenment philosophy, I think, caused Campbell to reason in some ways. Locke was big on trying to identify the essentials in any association. Campbell never writes about essentials. He never uses that word, at least that I can find. And trust me, I have not read everything that Campbell wrote. But these essentials seem to be important in Campbell's thinking. He doesn't like the schisms that he has to deal with. Remember, he's grown up with the Presbyterians splitting, and then they split within the split. And it just seemed like every time you turned around, there was a different Presbyterian group. So Campbell wants to bring all of those people together. And his idea of unity was that if we could find the essentials that everybody could agree on, we could be together. And then it was a question of, okay, what are the essentials? We're going to look at the Declaration and Address, and Thomas spends a lot of time talking about how he identified the essential practices. And those practices, he said, were the things for which the Bible provided, and this is his words, a thus saith the Lord, either in express terms or by approved precedent. That sounds familiar. That's not an absolutely new idea, but Campbell really takes that to heart. We're going to have unity. We're only going to insist on those practices that the Bible provides of thus saith the Lord, either in terms of an express commandment or an approved precedent. Now, he also talks about the question of inference, and we'll see that as we talk about this further. Now, unlike Locke, he agrees with Thomas Locke or John Locke on the matter of essentials. But unlike Locke, Campbell argued for a complete restoration of apostolic Christianity. He said if we could get back to the primitive church before it had been alloyed with all of the divisive practices that he was so familiar with, we could be together. And he argued for finding the apostolic pattern. And that apostolic pattern was, as he saw it, essential to having unity. If we could just get back and get rid of all the trappings of denominational thinking, get back to apostolic Christianity, we could be together. And so he was dreadfully opposed to creeds, because those creeds had been added to apostolic Christianity. So he wanted to get rid of the creeds. He wanted to strip away everything that wasn't a part of the original pattern. Does that sound familiar to everybody? Those are the kinds of things that you would probably hear me preaching. Those are the kinds of things that have formed the basis for our hermeneutic, our way of understanding biblical information. Now, he also argued that rational faith, and those were his words, rational faith. So faith is not some blind acceptance of an idea. Faith is based on rational thought. He says rational faith could be formulated and defended on the basis of a set of facts that could be derived from the Bible, from biblical information. And again, those are the kinds of things that you're going to hear me preaching. That's not, I can't turn to book, chapter, and verse that says rational faith can be defended on the basis of biblical facts. That's just my approach to how I understand biblical information. And it's incredibly important, because this is what starts people to thinking about the Bible and about the biblical information in a certain way. So what are your thoughts about Thomas? Thomas has been described as the kind of the more contemplative of the two, Thomas and Alexander. Alexander was the better speaker. Alexander wrote a lot more. Alexander started a journal, or started two journals. Alexander gave fiery sermons. Most famous sermon that he's known for is a sermon on the distinction between the Old Testament and the New Testament. So Thomas is kind of the thinker of the duo, and Alexander is the one that knows how to express it. Next week, we're going to look at, we'll start looking at the Declaration and Address. Now, I should tell you, the Declaration and Address is about 174 pages long. I will send you a copy of that text. Be aware that it's hard to read. You have to remember when these guys wrote. The style of their writing is nowhere close to a style that we're familiar with. If you read the New York Times is written basically on a somewhere between a sixth and an eighth grade reading level. Well, these guys didn't write that way. These guys wrote in language that sometimes you read a sentence and then you have to think about it for a minute and go back and read it again to be sure that you understood what they said in that sentence. And they have sentences that go on, sometimes for entire paragraphs. Sometimes when you're reading through the Declaration and Address, you'll see places where one sentence is a half a page. So I'm going to send you a PDF that is a copy, a digitized copy of the way it was originally printed. I also have a version of it that's done in more modern spelling, because remember, these guys were living at a time when S's looked like F's, and it's a little confusing to read, but I'll send you the PDF. And if you look, let's go back here. If you go let's see. I thought I put the URL for the updated version, but I didn't. I'll send you both of those. You don't need to read them all. We're going to go through the Declaration and Address is really two sections of one document. The declarations are, there are, I believe it's 13 declarations, and then there are seven arguments or issues that he discusses in the address. So we're going to talk about those. We'll focus on those. And I think you'll see how the language that he used to express some of these ideas in the Declaration and Address is language that you are likely to hear in sermons today, particularly if you're worshiping here at Coburg Grove. So, questions, comments, that may have prompted some questions, and I might be able to answer them. You know me well enough to know that if I don't know the answer, it doesn't bother me to say, I don't know. But sometimes I know the answer and I forget to put it in here.
It seems to me that he had the right idea all along. It just took him a long time to get there because he took a lot of steps to get to where he finally was, what he was trying to get across in the first place. And well, I guess his son helped him quite a bit on that also. But
you're right, Jimmy. One of the things that you'll be impressed with when we talk about Thomas O'Kelly was that O'Kelly, he thought that we should take the Lord's Supper every first day of the week. The worship that he organized looked very similar to the worship that you would be familiar with. probably the only disagreement that you would have with Thomas O'Kelly is that he hadn't seen that baptism should be by immersion.
So, it seems like when you're studying the Bible itself that you couldn't help but find that, you know, all of that, which is what Campbell essentially did in the end when he got it going.
And that's what O'Kelly wound up doing. But it's these guys that we have an advantage when we start with our Bible study. We have an advantage that we have teachers that are going to approach it this way. And so it's going to be a lot easier for us to understand. Mm-hmm. If you don't have teachers that are teaching it this way, if let's just say our elders had a completely different understanding and you were reading the Bible, it might take you a while to kind of get to the point where you think, you know, I think the elders are wrong. Because your first response is, I ought to listen to them. They know what they're talking about. But sometimes our continued study gets us to the point where we recognize that the people that we respected, the people that we listened to, they were wrong. It's okay. This is a learning experience for all of us. And it ought to be a continual learning experience for us. You know, you may listen to me preach about or teach about Matthew 25, and you may come to the conclusion that I'm all wet.
Probably not.
Well, you haven't heard me talk about Matthew 25 yet.
No, but I have a good idea.
So, you know, coming to an understanding of these things is a matter of constantly growing. And I am not what I was when I first started preaching. When I first became a Christian, there were a lot of things that I didn't know, a lot of things that I assumed. And there was a time when I thought the biblical information required me to be a pacifist. And for that reason, I was a conscientious objector and would have refused to bear arms. I have since, with further study, come to the conclusion that I was wrong about that. And there are other things, but that's one of those things where I was wrong. And I grew up in a family and in a church that didn't teach that. And to my dad's credit, he disagreed with me when I had to defend myself before the draft board. And if you claim conscientious objector status, they're going to call you in and they're going to question you. And to his credit, my dad disagreed with me, but he did say that's what he believes based on his own Bible study. So it's not just a matter of convenience. It's not just that he's opposed to the Vietnam War. It is a matter of his Bible study. And, you know, it's not to my credit, but at one time I did say, if someone attacked my wife and children, I would not kill them to protect my wife and children. Because I was convinced that killing was wrong. That was, you know, we all grow. And growing through this, I went through the same kinds of growing pains that these guys were going through. So I have a great affinity for them. They came out of the darkness. I don't know if you've ever come from a totally dark room into a well-lit room. And when you first walk into the light, it's hard to see. So these guys are coming out of darkness and they're coming into the light, and it takes them a while to figure out what's going on.
Well, it takes a lot of study, that's for sure, because I've changed my mind on a couple of things, but it was brought to my attention by a teacher, and then you studied it through yourself and then compared it to it, and you changed your mind.
Yep.
You did, you know, you did what you thought was right, but then you've discovered a new thing. And I've discovered a lot of new words that I didn't know when I'm reading every day now and looking at them. Oh, wow. I wonder what that manna means. And it means, what is it? That's what the word means. Not.
And Jimmy, that's to your credit, to your everlasting credit, that you're willing to look at the biblical information. And if it turns out that what you had been teaching was wrong, you change your mind.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot to be said for the teachers too, because you listen and you do think about it, but then when you challenge him, quote, because that's what I like to do, and I'm like you, I would like to argue, but anyhow, you just keep asking questions until you get it right, because he didn't know something that I knew that I could input, and vice versa, you know. And then he told me, people your age would never believe that. How do you know that? And I said, I just know it from study. I don't know how to tell you anything different.
So. Sure. That happened to me when I, you know, when I was 50 years old, when I went back to graduate school. And it didn't bother me when I heard a professor tell me that this is absolutely true. If I knew it wasn't, it didn't bother me to speak up and say, hey, that's just not true. That sometimes got me in trouble, just like the Campbells got in trouble with their associations and Stone got in trouble with the Synod. And, you know, many times it's the young whippersnapper who is speaking up. And sometimes the older teachers have a tendency to say, well, who do you think you are? I've been studying this for 50 years. And that cannot be our approach. That kind of shutting down any kind of disagreement will never be my approach. If I ever do that, I'll stop preaching. Now, I will argue tooth and nail for biblical information. But if I ever shut down someone who has a question, I'll quit preaching.
You can always say, I have to look that up and study it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have to do that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know me well enough to know that if somebody says something and I'm not familiar with it, I freely say I'm not familiar with it. I'm just going to have to look. I'm going to have to study that out for myself. Well, thank you, guys. I appreciate your kind attention, and hopefully this is important to us. As you read some of the stuff that's in the Declaration and Address, I think you'll hear some language that you're probably familiar, just like tonight. Thus saith the Lord. I mean, that's the language that we use. It's important to understand where this comes from, where this approach comes from.